one-hour dramas, you know. You do 13 one-hour dramas on radio today, and you'd be deader than a mackerel.
And they were done in the studios underneath the, down below the Grosvenor Hotel in that old Studio A that was still there when I was there.
We were mentioning some of the great names in broadcasting that went through CJOR. I saw Andrew Allen, who became the dean of radio dramatists, and I can't see a cabbage today without thinking of Andrew Allen, because they were doing a program about Nazi perfidy and so on and so forth, and a spy story. It was about 1942 and 1941. And Andrew Allen was supposed to be a Nazi torturing some prisoner, and he was beating a cabbage with a length of iron pipe, you know, clunk, clunk on this darn cabbage, you see. And then there was Andrew Angus Young, better known as Alan Young, a little bit later on. And he was one of the graduates of those CJOR dramas done in the place below the stairs there.
John Drenny, Alan Young, yeah. Andrew Allen.
Andrew Allen, you name them. Al Pierce was another man who went on to radio broadcasting in Eastern Canada. Almost anyone who became anyone, Frank Vivian, who was more or less a CBC person,
right,
also took part in those dramas, as did E.V. Young. So many of them. Jimmy Johnson was a performer down there with his charming wife. So many people. We did so much drama, and we kept so many of those actors alive in those days, you know, by paying them $15 a shot to do a one-hour drama. That's the way it was. And we did all kinds of live things. Everything was live in the evening. Did you know, when the Board of Broadcast Governors of the CBC controlled radio broadcasting in Canada, there was a period up until about, the late 40s, when you could not play any recorded music between 7:30 and 11 o'clock at night. It had to be live.
All this Canadian content wasn't new at all then.
Oh, no, no. And our Canadian content in those days was the great Leo Nicholson doing lacrosse games or auto races or the wrestling matches. And many people used to say, you know, did you go to the wrestling match last night? And they'd say, no, I stayed home and listened to Leo Nicholson, because it was a much better match at home than it was down there in the ring, down at the old auditorium.
He wasn't... I'm thinking of somebody else that's before my time. I vaguely remember him. Goodnight, Kelly.
Earl Kelly, yeah. He was before your time, but he was very much a part of my time down there at CJOR. Kelly did not come originally to CJOR. He was the province newsreader for CKCD, Uncle Billy Hassel's station. And when Earl came to CJOR, he was getting close to the end of a great and illustrious career. He was a fascinating man. I don't suppose too many people ever saw him read a news broadcast, but he brought it into the studio on a piece of teletype paper, which might be 8 to 10 feet long. And he would stand up in front of the microphone. He always did his news broadcasts standing up. And he would get this great length of teletype paper and begin at the top with his celebrated good evening, you know, and so on, all the rest of it, and plod through the news. He was an irascible character. I had to deal with him, particularly during the early days of war censorship in 1940 and 1941, and he was a tough old bird, played tennis like a madman until he was, I would think, in his 70s.
What was his closing line?
Oh, his most famous closing line was, of course, he used to say, he used to spot the position of the good ship McQuinna, which plied the coastal trade and supplied a lot of the little outposts with their stuff. So he always said to ships at sea, to lighthouse keepers, and his most memorable one, he looked slyly over his spectacles at me and said, and especially to June brides. And that brought a lot of reaction in those days. People thought that was pretty coarse broadcasting. You know, there was innuendo there that people could read into what he said, and to wish a good and happy night to June brides was carrying things a little bit too far. So
the next voice you hear will be one whom you taught how to stand at a microphone, or sit at a microphone, or turn on a tape machine. They weren't wire recorders, they were magna cords.
We had magna cords. Before that, we had the little brown box, which was called the... I forget the name of that thing. The very first...
Wirec.
No, it wasn't Wirec. No, we had RCA wire recorders, but before that, there was the one which became the stock in trade. Every radio station had one. I just forget the trade name of the thing now, but it was a very simple little tape recorder that used paper magnetic tape instead
of... I'm waiting to see if you recognize the next voice after these messages.
Okay.
At 685-9181. Okay. Okay, listen to this one, Vic. And I don't think I've changed that much since January the 23rd, 1955.
This is Jack Webster, and this is City Mike. And what I'd like to do now is to sit back calmly and marshal the facts of the dramatic developments which led tonight to the appointment of a new temporary chief constable for the city of Vancouver. And just a moment ago, you heard us get our wires slightly crossed on a tape recording I'm going to use, because later in the program, I want you to meet the man who is undoubtedly directly responsible for the blow-up, Raymond Rowe, ex-Sun reporter, ex-Province reporter, and now Western editor of Flash Weekly of Toronto. Now, up until last night, all we had to face was a growing crisis caused by the charges made in Flash Weekly magazine by Monroe. Now, I can't and shouldn't give you the chapter and verse on those charges. Suffice it to say that they were highly serious charges of graft and corruption, mismanagement and laxity in Vancouver Police Department spreading over a period of years. Monroe started his charges 2 issues ago. The Rape of Vancouver, he called it, and in the stories, he specifically named Len Cuthbert as being involved. The police commission went into a huddle after that and issued a statement which said, in effect, oh yes, we've had these charges before, 6 years ago, as a matter of fact. And at that time, we wanted the Mounties to investigate them, but they wouldn't. So we held our own investigation, and the charges made at that time, 6 years ago, were not confirmed. And they added, but if anybody knows anything of any wrongdoing in the police department, they should get in touch with the city prosecutor at once. The next step was when Chief Constable Mulligan started a libel suit for damages against the paper Flash and against Monroe. And yesterday, the whole commission, the police commission, the chairman of which, Mayor Hume, has consistently and publicly, when Chief Mulligan has been under attack, and there have been lots of attacks, has consistently and publicly expressed his complete confidence in Mulligan, went into 2 secret huddles. After the first huddle, the commission said nothing. They asked Bob Bonner, the Attorney General, to attend the second huddle. And you mustn't forget that he is the chief law enforcement officer, the top policeman, you might say, in B.C. And after that meeting, the commissioners admitted that they had discussed certain matters about police administration, but that it would be premature for a few days yet to make specific announcements. Well, it might have been premature if it hadn't been for the tragic incident this morning, when Detective Sergeant Len Cuthbert put a bullet through his own chest. Now, everybody in the department from the chief down knew that Cuthbert, the man named in Flash, was in a terrible state of nerves. In fact, when that tragic revolver shot went off this morning at 12 minutes past 8, an officer that I know in another part of the building lifted his head and he said, "There goes Cuthbert."
That's enough of that. That's a rebroadcasting from January 23rd, 1955, the day that one policeman shot himself and lived, by the way, and the day they appointed a temporary chief constable, and not for the life of me can I remember who that was, except maybe it was Rossiter. Can't remember.
No, nor can I. You forget to mention, and I think your modesty is to your credit, that you changed the face of radio reporting in Vancouver. We had never had anything like it before, and it was the Mulligan hearings, the police hearings, I suppose more than almost anything else that brought you into local and national prominence.
As a matter of fact, we discovered news talk and didn't recognize it because people used to line up in the radios over in the cars of Vancouver Island to listen to Webster doing his verbatim shorthand transcript.
From my shorthand notes.
Yeah, yes. I used to come on the air and say, "Good evening, this is Jack Webster and this is City Mike. Tonight you will hear the full story of today's hearings. It wasn't in the Sun today, and it won't be in the Province tomorrow."
I regret that I didn't have time. It was past very busy week to dig out that little tape I have, which is the first one you made at CJOR, and there's a memorable line on that tape, which I shall never forget. You promised your audience that in the future, as long as you lived and were a broadcaster in Vancouver, there was one thing you would never be, and that was a professional Scot. Because you said if there was one thing you abhorred, it was your day-to-day contacts with professional Scots. Could you deny that today, I wonder?
Yeah, I think I could. I've never been a professional Scotsman.
Well, a great many people agree that your Scottish, your Glaswegian accent is a little heavier and a little thicker today, like the consistency of good Scottish oatmeal than it was, than it was back in those days.
Listen again. That's a lie, Vic Waters. I should be back on here. We'll be in a second.
No action could be too premature for the police commission. As one of the papers, The Sun, pointed out today, there is a blue book for police conduct. And when a man, an officer of the force, is accused...
Are you telling me that my accent is less then than it is today?
Well, it's a little more refined today. You see, you've done too many broadcasts with Warnet Kennedy, and his Edinburgh refined is rubbing off on you. I think you're coming around. And Gordon Jackson...
I am a
Jackson,
little less Scotch, I must say.
Well, possibly. I don't know. You're a lot more Canadian, but on the air, you're still pretty much of a Scotsman.
I remember you putting me through, though. You and Jack Sharp. I had written two or three different scripts. One was on the stupid liquor laws we had. One was on something to do with the police.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a couple of very pathetic interviews. And I remember you standing there hammering me, and I had this carefully typed out script.
Well, one thing you didn't realize, you sat in front of the mic very demurely, and with your, I think, your hands folded in front of you on the table, and you did your, "Good evening, this is Jack Webster, and this is City Mike," and all the rest of it, and it came out sort of as a monotone, and afterwards we tried to analyze just what was wrong, why you weren't the Webster that we knew you were. And suddenly, we discovered you weren't using your hands. And it's when you began to broadcast and hit your fist into your hand and hit the desk and all the rest of it, then you became alive and you became the Jack Webster that you are today.
More the pity I sometimes think.
Well, I don't know. Radio news needed a big shot in the arm. The whole coverage of the local scene needed a big shot. Before that, radio news broadcast, when I came to work at CJOR in 1939, we had three news broadcasts a day. 8 a.m. in the morning, 12 noon, and 10 o'clock at night, with occasionally during the war special bulletins, which Dick Diespecker, as the Texaco reporter, put in by pressing a siren. And this great screaming siren would go off, you know, and he would announce that the Nazis had invaded Norway, for example, or something like that. And I know that old siren was kicking around the studio there for years and years, but some of the early radio news broadcasts on CJOR, the province news, that was prepared by the province, clipped out of the newspaper, pasted onto sheets, and handed to the newsreader, who merely read what the province, what their point of view was, what their biases were for today, you see.
I should give a mention to a chap who's listening this morning, but he couldn't make it down, by the name of Jimmy Swan.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Swan, who... In those days, there was no such thing, really, as a usable portable tape recorder. We wanted broadcast quality, so we used to carry these huge magnacorders in two sections.
That's right, yeah.
In and out of the Hotel Vancouver. This was the source of my... principal source of interviews in those days.
Let me tell you about one evening in 1939. Since we couldn't broadcast phonograph records between 7:30 and 11 o'clock, we had to keep the air filled with live broadcasting. One night, I met Dorwin Baer down in the studio about 6:30. We hefted all of these huge amplifiers and got on a streetcar because we had streetcar passes, and we went out to McAllister Park where they were doing the midget auto races. We broadcast the midget auto races. We packed all of this heavy gear up, got on the streetcar again, went down to the embassy ballroom where we did a half-hour broadcast with the embassy orchestra, whatever it was. Then we climbed on a streetcar again, went from Davie Street back up to the Commodore Cabaret where we broadcast Ole Olsen and his Commodore Band. Now, that's the way we used to have to hustle around in those days for the magnificent sum of, guess how much?
$15 a week.
No,
25.
20 bucks a week.
Darwin died, what, a year or so ago?
No, about 4 or 5 years ago.
4 or 5 years?
Mm-hmm, that's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And did you have broadcast lines into all these locations?
Yes, we had broadcast lines in more places in Vancouver than you could possibly imagine. I'll tell you about some of them in a
moment. Oh, for the good old days. 685-9181. CJOR's 50th birthday. Our 50th birthday. There's got to be an occasion. And there are a few still around. Jack's Shot still around. Al Jordan's still around. Not from the 50th birthday, but of the old-timers. And the else, Monty, of course, is a real old-timer.
Monty came to us in about 51 or 52 by way of the State Express program. The State Express was putting on a program, a 15-minute DJ program in the evening. And it carried a talent fee. And you know what that meant in those days? Your miserable $45 a week salary might be expanded to $60 if you got the show. Well, the State Express people came out to Vancouver and they auditioned everyone at CJOR. And the producer said, no, none of you have really got it. The opening of the program particularly was critical because it had to do with the words "all aboard the State Express." And it had to sound like an old railway
conductor. All aboard. Good, yeah.
and none of us could really do it. But we wanted that program and the revenue, you see. So, being an extremist, we reached out over to CKMO, where Monty was working at that time, and asked him to come over and audition. And shrewd old Monty came over, and the guy said, yeah, that's the voice we want. That is the man. And Monty said, fine, okay. They got him in a corner, you know, and George Chandler was trying to get him for $21.50 a week plus $8 and a bag of bananas on Sunday. And Monty was too shrewd. He said, no, I want a job here at CJOR, and then I'll come and do the State Express program. So the deal was made, and Monty did the State Express program successfully for its run of 52 weeks. And became a permanent part of the staff, and a funny guy. He used to do some of the most incredible things on the air. He was part of the soap show chain in the afternoon when CJOR carried, you know, Life Can Be Beautiful, Ma Perkins, and all the rest of them. And one of them was Vitalis or something or other that dealt with the horrible disease you could get in your scalp called Pity Ross Porama Valley. And it took Monty a week to master this word, and when he mastered it, instead of calling it Pity Ross Porama Valley, he called it Pity Ross Porama Valeroony, which is typical of things that he did. Life was never, never dull when Monty was around.
I remember with great warmth and affection Billy Brown Jr., who went on to great success with his own radio stations in Vancouver Island. But what about Billy Brown Sr.?
One of the great, great broadcasters of Vancouver, and a man who was infinitely wise. He was showbiz all the way through. He taught me one very important lesson. He listened to me when I first came to work as a radio broadcaster at CJOR. Called me in one day, tilted his hat on the back of his head and said, you've got one thing to learn. And I said, what's that, Mr. Brown? And he said, it's the value of a pause. He said, you get on the air there and you go like a blue streak. He said, you'll never sell anything that way. You'll never convince anyone that way. He said, if you're doing a 60-second announcement, he said, maybe about 30 seconds of that should be pauses. And he proved it on an amazing program called Remember When for a cake mix. He was getting 15,000 letters a week. You know, mailbags were coming down there at night. I was his operator in the nighttime for the program Remember When. And you had to really be on the button because old Billy knew what he was doing. Every light in the studio was down to an absolute minimum. He was sitting in there in the gloom. I could hardly see him. And he would rest his chin on his hand and talk about the old dumbbells or about Morris Gunsky, who sang Lay My Head Beneath a Rose or something like that. And he used the pregnant pause in broadcasting more frequently and better than anyone I've ever heard. He was just an absolute marvel.
He was dead before I came to the station, I think.
Yes, he was. He did, of course, Echoes of the British Empire, too.
And I remember band music. That was Billy Brown Jr., too, wasn't it?
Yeah, Reddy Rooster and all the rest of it, you see. And
Rooster, that strikes a chord.
Reddy Rooster, yeah, I used to crow to start the program every morning with that march and then the voice of Reddy Rooster. And away they'd go. And young Bill carried on the tradition to great effect up in Courtney when he got his broadcasting station up there, CFCP. Billy Brown, of course, goes back to radio broadcasting at CKMO in the 20s when he did a program called The Sky Rakers. And this was a disc jockey program, and one of the very first. He was involved in a number of firsts in radio broadcasting in Vancouver. And there's a story I love to tell about Bill. I think Bill Jr. thinks possibly it may not be true. But people in radio broadcasting, then, they were all colorful. Today, there are not too many colorful broadcasters, but they were all colorful in those days. And the York Hotel was just across the street from CKMO, and anybody who broadcast at CKMO went over to the York Hotel to sort of reprise the broadcast afterwards or something like that. Billy Brown walked in one night with a rooster under his arm, ordered drinks for the house, a drink for himself, and a beer for the rooster. You know, they don't make them that way anymore.
Vic Waters and Webster on OR's 50th birthday at 685-9181. Those birthdays as well as ours.
Yeah, you haven't mentioned Ronnie Matthews yet, but maybe some of the listeners will. Maybe some of the listeners will mention some of those great people who came through.
This lady's been waiting for an hour. Go ahead to Vic Waters.
Hi, Jack. Hi, Vic. I was your music librarian in 1950 at OR.
What was your name?
My name at that time was Marion Bolster, and I married one of the announcers there, Bjorn Bjornsson.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I remember you, Marion. Yeah, I saw you up in Kelowna a few years later. That's right. I remember you wore big, sloopy, sexy black hats. And you were fond of wearing black, too, and... Yep, that's right. Mm-hmm. Bjorn Bjornsson was an announcer at CJOR, and he went through that incredible performance with all the rest of us of struggling up to the White Rose Ballroom on Broadway and broadcasting some cowboy, you know...
Oh, I remember. When I was working there, I can recall every day, practically, there was something going on that... It was just not normal around there. There was something to laugh at. It was a lot of fun. It was a great experience in my life working down there.
How long were you there, Marion?
Well, about a year, I think. And then when I married, we went up to Penticton. Sorry to correct you, Vic, but...
Yeah, that's right. It was Penticton.
Yeah, and the only one that I can still remember is Monty. I still hear him every morning, and he's the only one there, I think, isn't he, from that time?
From 1950, yes, he must be the only...
Do you want to
Jack Short. Jack Short is there,
yeah. Do you want to talk about another record librarian at CJOR, a slim, blonde little fellow who had a not unpleasant singing voice? It was demure, proper at all times, and the softest person you could ever meet.
Oh, I don't remember.
Ray Peters.
Oh, yes. And his brother's Wally.
Yeah, Wally was there, of course, and with Alice Peters, or Alice Peterson, she was before she married Wally. And Wally was the musical director of CJOR. But Ray Peters, one of the toughest nails in television broadcasting in North America today, and a very capable manager, believe you me, was record librarian at CJOR. That would have been about 1954 or 1955, during the bop era.
No, remember he bebop? Wasn't there when I was there.
Oh, he was there. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Was he?
Oh, yes, he was. Yeah, not for a great period of time, because he was ambitious and had a lot of drive. And he went down to, I think, CHCH in Hamilton and became a member of the sales corps down there. And I think before long he was probably sales manager. And then he was chosen as the man to eventually manage Channel 8 in Vancouver.
Yeah, he's still here, isn't he?
Oh, you bet he is, yep.
Vic, what happened to Keith Cutler?
Oh, he went on to great successes.
Yes, he went into films with
KVOS.
KVOS, yes, and their film production unit. And he won several awards for...
Matter of fact, I filled the spot vacated by Keith Cutler in 1953 when I came to the station. And I still see Keith very much in evidence as the voice of Pacific Western Airlines mm-hmm. on the hockey broadcast last year and
that's
on other
right.
occasions.
Yeah, he's involved in the production of television programs, and film became his great interest after
very
a while.
Nice guy.
Yeah, showed great talent at it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Any other names, Marion?
Yeah, Vince Duggan. I think he's with CBC, isn't he,
CBC yep. Television mm-hmm. News.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. See Vince once in a while.
Remember Jeff Ajello?
Yes, I remember Jeff Ajello, and I remember a battle that he and Charles Hovey had one night with a wine bottle. Jeff Ajello went kind of out of his nut and was going to smash Charles Hovey over the head with a wine bottle. And Charles was about 6'4" and weighed about 250 pounds. And he wrested the wine bottle away from Jeff Ajello and calmed him down. But Charles Hovey was a performer on CJOR for many years. I can still sing a few bars of his theme song.
In the gloaming, oh, my darling, when the lights are soft and low.
And his accompanist was Alan Thompson, a noted organist around Vancouver, church organist and other...
Just before we take the break, I remember Bruno Simulai before he went to CBC.
Yeah, I hired Bruno Simulai, Bill Skelcher...
Doug Campbell.
Telford
Oliver.
Yeah, Red Robinson. I hired all of those guys.
Hartley Ivesky.
They all went on and became great successes, and look at me today.
Oh, yeah, some failure you are. Thanks, Marion. Nice of you to call.
Great to hear your voice, Vic.
Bye. Go ahead, please.
Hello, it's Nina Anthony calling.
Nina, how nice to hear you.
I couldn't resist it. I went to OR in 1942-43, before your time, before Vic's time. And,
Before my time, Nina. I was there before you were in 1938-39. I was away fighting the Japanese in the Pacific.
Oh, yeah, you were with the rest of the boys. That's how I got my job. That and the fact I worked the slide rule. And Doran Baird, God bless him, got me in there. Because I was making $13.75 a week, which was a heck of a lot more than I was making at the Bay.
Well, were you in competition with Sue and her notebook, who was on CJOR at that time?
I wanted to talk about Sue, because Sue had Sue's notebook, which was one of the the main women's show, and Sue got married, and I took it over.
Oh, right. Her name was Mrs. Sturrock, and once when she went on holidays, I did her program for a week. What a disaster that was, a kid about 20 years old doing a woman's program.
Hughes was the organist, and we were in that crazy old studio where later, when I went to work for Jimmy Lovick, we used to do produce grand old songs with Isabel McEwen.
Yeah.
Produce. But, oh, golly, there's just so many people, and I just recalled it, and I couldn't help but call up, because George Chandler, as you know, I'm no woman's libber, but it wasn't the desperation of the war with George. He just delighted in giving women a chance in the radio business, but I must say we were no good in a control room, Vic.
Well, I don't know. I never had you in the control room or near one, Nina, so I couldn't really comment on that.
Well, now, we're talking about the operation of a radio station. And there was no... You mean the women couldn't hand-push the buttons?
I'm not talking about hanky-panky. No, they went to pieces when
under pressure.
Yeah.
Well, Nina Anthony, you never did go to pieces under pressure later on in WX and with the Red Cross and your other multifarious activities.
Well, all I can remember about O.R. was with great affection, because there were so many wonderful people that you were mentioning that I met while I was working there. And, of course, Monty McFarlane might have started there, but I, at one time, for about a year and a half, was the program director at old CKMO. And a disastrous time of my life, at which time I had Monty and Jack Cullen, and you name all the bad boys, I had them.
They were the good boys, Nina. You never really hit the bad boys. You never had me over there.
No, I never did, Vic.
Nina, a million thanks. Keep well.
Thank you.
I'll tell Finn you phoned.
Oh, do. How is he?
He's fine. Thanks very much, Nina.
Bye.
Bye.
He's a beautiful person.
Go ahead, please.
Yes, Jack and Vic, happy birthday to both of you. Did Dick DeSpecker do the home oil show, Vic?
No, he didn't do the home oil show. No, he was the Texaco news broadcaster. The home oil show featured Calvin Winter and his band.
Yeah, and Isabel McEwen.
That's right, yep. Mm-hmm.
He also was trying to...
Hold on, I'll talk to you off the air. Next, the 11 o'clock news.
To Jordan.
How many kids did you have as a member of your club in those days?
Well, with varying fan clubs, they really... I didn't have any fan club for me, but Tony Bennett was very big, and Frankie Lane, I guess, was the biggest, wasn't he, big?
Very, very big, yep, that's right.
Yeah, we stopped
the program.
We're speaking with Al Jordan.
Absolutely. And who invented it? You did.
I don't know whether I did or not, but it had its ups and downs. It went very, very well when you did the program. Then it went into a lapse when we had another chap who latterly went to the United States.
He'll be nameless, I gather?
He'll be nameless, yeah, because he flopped out. And then the young kid in the T-shirt came along after that, and that was a different story. Yeah.
This was the young kid in the T-shirt?
No, he wasn't a young. He was a...
We wore ties in those days,
yeah, Jim. Alan was always a very conscientious, proper broadcaster.
Oh, the young kid in the T-shirt was Red Robinson.
That's right.
He used to hang around your coattails all the time, as I recall.
He used to write scripts for that show. He worked at school, and he also worked at radio. He didn't really know anything about it except that he did it. He's a natural. Yeah.
But you were a natural, too. It's a shame you didn't stay on the broadcasting side of the business.
Well, a shame for who, Jack?
It's a shame that he stayed in Vancouver, because with that million-dollar voice, and if I was his manager, we would be down in New York or Nashville.
You'd be down in New York. I'd
or
be
Los
in
Vancouver somewhere, and we would just be making pots of money.
Alan, fond recollections of the early days in O.R.? When did you get there? 50-something?
I was pretty soft when I got there. Vic and some of the earlier people had to live on the starvation wages. By the time I got there, I think it was paying $300 a month, wasn't it, Vic?
Yeah, I think that's about right. Yeah.
I remembered you well, though, being around all the time when I was running around with Jimmy Swan and my 10 questions on the back of an envelope to ask of Walter Ruther or Cora, Victor Jory.
Jimmy was very capable. He always got you plugged in and on time, though, didn't he?
Oh, Jimmy. Jimmy was great.
Excellent.
Jimmy was great.
A lot of dedicated people. A lot of people who liked working.
We loved broadcasting. Everybody. We had no cranks in the outfit. Everybody loved what they were doing.
But didn't you have great adulation from all your teenage fans in those days?
Well, I made it possible for them to get to the people that they did idolize. And they, as I say, the Louis Armstrong, for instance, we packed Howe Street, both sides, all across the middle.
Stop traffic.
Police came and said, would you please break up the show? Because
that's right.
The kids had had a chance to meet and talk to and touch their favorite stuff.
You mean in that old place across the street, which was called?
The Playhouse.
Yeah.
CJR Playhouse.
Mm-hmm.
CJR Radio Theater.
That was the home of the original merry-go-round.
WX had the Playhouse. We had the Radio Theater.
Mm-hmm.
We used to originate programs there to the Dominion Network of the CBC. Many of them.
I used to bootleg programs, in case you didn't know, from my CJR City mics onto something called...
Not impact.
I'm sure that you both helped me to edit them. I had to cut my 10-minute city mic down to 3 minutes and 50 seconds.
Yeah, I remember that.
A program called what?
The name will come to me, don't worry.
On the Dominion Network.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Lloyd Hoole cashed in on that, too, when he left CJOR, and he was a very busy boy.
He was a very good broadcaster, but a very good businessman, but a terribly poor broadcaster.
Well, he's a good businessman. Let's leave it at that. You know, he chose his route, and he went his route, and that became a business, an operating radio station.
Oh, other recollections of the good old days.
I remember Ralph Spaulding. You remember Ralph Spaulding?
Ralph Spaulding?
Yeah.
I remember Captain Spaulding. Of course, he was a friend of Groucho Marx's.
Right.
Ralph Spaulding.
Well, this Ralph Spaulding was the name Marty used when he didn't want his friends to know he was announcing on the soap opera programs.
Really? Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that was his very
favorite
name.
You know, I sometimes
name.
Did midnight news broadcasts on CJOR using the name Jeffrey Carter. And I did them in that accent.
Just a minute. Ralph Spaulding. Mm. That is a nom de plume from
that was Marty's plume, yeah.
Nom de plume. Now that he's out of town, is there any more debt you can give me to throw at him at 7:58 in the morning?
I have never seen a guy operate a disc jockey show so nonchalantly as he did. The first time I saw Marty work was one Saturday afternoon. And the phone used to come off the wall behind him, so he'd have that propped up in his shoulder. He was standing. The record was playing and had about an eighth of an inch of groove left, and that was a 78. It was traveling, eh? He's reading a newspaper, checking out the ball scores or something, and talking to his pal where they're going to, you know, have golf tomorrow. And he said he's got big hands. You were talking about the fella chasing the Gigi man. Got big hands, Marty does. And he reached over just as the last dying note of Peggy Lee had gone into the air.
Peggy Lee.
Off came the arm, hand on the... Usually you have a record ready. We call it queuing up, you know, and that one's all set to play. You hit the switch, bang, it's on the air. He just takes a hand and lays it flat on that 78. Curls a little at the edge, and up it comes. And he was sitting down at the time and just reaching out at the microphone switch at the same time. Everything's on a single switch, or a separate switch, as we might tell people out there. Meantime, the paper just magically slid off his shoulder. The phone slid down the other shoulder, you know. This guy was in no hurry. He was beautiful, so composed, but didn't you ever bother anything in that room, because he had everything set down exactly where he knew about it. He taught me a good lesson there.
Very,
very tidy man.
I got a real dirty piece about Monty McFarlane, but it's a funny piece.
We wait
at the same time. No, every year, because Dorwin Baird used to editorialize favorably.
Around home.
Yeah, that's right, for the BC Hydro.
And the BC Dell.
At Christmas time, they always sent him a very special gift, and it came down in a huge wicker basket, and it made the most beautiful clinking sound, and some of it came from Scott. Some of it came from France.
BC Electric.
It was one of the most beautiful packages of Christmas stuff you've ever seen. And this came down every Christmas regularly. One Christmas party, it was Christmas Eve in the afternoon about 4:30. Monty McFarlane and I were standing at the bottom of the old stairs that came down past the barber shop. And this guy came down in a messenger's uniform carrying a huge wicker basket. And he said, I have a package for Dorwin Baird. Monty said, I am Dorwin Baird. Took the package out of the guy's arm, whistled it back into the men's can, gave me a whistle because I had seen him do it, and said, how will we divide it up? Do you like scotch or French wine?
Listeners next at 685-9181. Three professional talkers here, Jordan, Waters, and Webster. We've got to let the listeners in. You will allow me, won't you?
I think it's a privilege, sir.
Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yes, happy birthday, CGR, and hello, Jack and Vic. Jack, you said you were Billy Brown Sr. had gone slightly before you got there.
Right.
But Vic would probably remember what his closing line, which is just about as well-known as Mr. Good Evening's was. He used to always say, today is the day we worried about yesterday, and again, everything is all right.
Yeah, he used to use that on CKWX, too, on a program called Billy Brown's Brevities in the afternoon, but that was in the mid-30s.
Yeah, well, oh, he had this in, later than that.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know. He had about a 15-minute program for books.
Today is the...
Were you in the business yourself?
No, I wasn't.
Just a listener.
Yeah.
Just a listener. Thanks for your call. Go ahead, please.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, Jack.
Yeah.
Good morning. It's your guest.
But... What's that in the background?
Closing it so I can hear.
We can use that sound effect.
He's got his own phone booth in his house.
Your guest I'm interested in, Vic Waters, goes back to your pre-broadcasting days. We went to school together.
Holy mackerel. I was only there part of the time.
They have schools named Vic out here.
Name, please.
Sid McGowan.
Oh, I know you, Sid. Sure, I remember you.
Yeah, you and I chased around the South Pacific at different times, I think, during the war.
Yeah, we sure did.
Yeah, and I got back. I remember phoning up one night. I was painting the kitchen in the house when I lived on Wellington Avenue. About 11:30 one night, you had a night show going, and I didn't know who it was. I hadn't really listened to radios very much, just getting established after coming back after the war. And I'm painting away in the kitchen, and then this voice starts talking about high school and going down the old China Creek flats, laying back in the grass and the sun shining down on him, and looks up, and there's a man looking down on Mr. Dunning, the principal, caught you.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Long way back, and it seems the only time I ever hear from you is all or hear about you is when you're on the radio program, or you're on a reunion sort of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
1951, 61?
Yes, I did. Yep, that's right.
Nobody knew him.
They knew me all.
Thank you, Sid. Go ahead, please.
Oh, the only name I haven't heard mentioned is Jerry Wilmot. What happened to him, Vic?
Well, we mentioned Jerry Wilmot earlier. Jerry left CJOR in about 37 or 38, and he went to the BBC and went to Bermuda and places like that. He went on to...
Oh, he became a very big noise in
oh,
the
yes.
BBC.
Oh, he did. Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. Don't cut me out.
Okay.
Another one is Leo Nicholson.
Leo Nicholson.
We mentioned him, too, this morning.
No, we mentioned Leo. In fact, in 1933, 1934, Leo Nicholson had a program in the afternoon, a kids program, a talent program, and my wife, Thelma, appeared on Leo Nicholson's program in 1934, playing the piano.
One more thing. I worked on a certain radio station, which will remain nameless.
It's nice, isn't it?
To leave my station to go around the corner to get a copy of your news off the teletype.
Well, I wouldn't doubt that.
And that was old Squeaky Mole.
Yes, that's right. I don't know what we stole from you, but quite a few guys who became good announcers.
Ask Cullen what he stole from whom. Thanks a million. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Vic.
Yeah.
I'd like to tell you a little story about Mr. Goodevening that nobody's ever heard before. It's about when I was broadcasting the Province News after Hassel left.
Yep.
I was one of the great unknowns. I'm still unknown as far as that goes. But I was helping out Mr. Hassel. He asked me if I ever did any broadcasting. I said, no, I haven't. He was doing the evening news, the Province News, and he said, he got halfway through and he handed the script and he said, go ahead. So I went ahead and read it off without any anything, no fuss at all. So he said, well, how'd you like to do it for the next couple of weeks? So I was going up there 8 o'clock every night. I was just a youngster, of course, and I was quite proud of my achievements, you know. So anyway, I used to get the script from Mr. Goodevening, you know, on the desk there every night, just about 7:45. So at Mr. Goodevening, I was told Goodevening was going to take it over, you see, Earl. So first night, I introduced him to the microphone, you know, and showed him how to turn the switch on when the you know, we had the power station up on the top floor. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And he went off pretty good, you know, in his style. And of course, you can imagine the training he got from me and my limited knowledge of the...
Was that Goodevening Kelly's first broadcast?
Yes, that was his first broadcast.
What's your name, sir?
Well, it wouldn't make any difference.
You sure?
Yes, it wouldn't. And anyway, this next night, I went with, I stood by till he broadcast. And the third night, I think it was, I left him to it, you see. So he got down as usual on the routine, and we had the microphone on the piano. It was a green light and a red light. And when the green light came on, it meant he was on the air, you see. And you had to turn this little switch. Well, he forgot to turn the switch, and for 10 minutes he was talking to himself.
It's been done.
That's pretty lonely.
I often do, but thank you, sir. Well, sorry you won't tell me your name.
Pardon?
What's your name?
Well, it doesn't make any difference, Jack, at all.
You want us to remain anonymous despite your brilliant broadcasting career. Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Hello. I was a very lonely newcomer in 1946, and I turned on the radio one day, and there was Billy Brown with his Breakfast with Brown, it was called.
Was that the old man or the young man?
Old man.
The old man, and it was called Breakfast with Brown. And I was so thrilled, I cried. I cried all through the program because he played British tunes. But I enjoyed it, and I used to listen to it every day. But he used to either start or finish program with something about beautiful British Columbia morning.
Yeah, it's a beautiful day in British Columbia, or words to that effect.
Well,
yeah.
Billy Brown Jr. used to say it's a beautiful British Columbia.
Beautiful.
British Columbia morning.
Yes,
right.
It was.
Anyway, you came out as a war bride.
It could be pouring down buckets, but he'd always say that just the same, and it used to make me laugh, you know. But he had another program, Remember When, and on it he used to play a tune, and there were no words, there was just the tune. And you would write in if you knew the name of that tune. And
I've got an old tape of that here, but it's not playable.
You were lucky, Jack. You got picked. And I happened to get picked. And was I ever thrilled? Because, as Vic says, there must have been thousands of letters come in. Anyway, the tune that I recognized, because my father had had an old recording of it, was Too Hot to Cut the Mustard. I won this thing, and I was told to be down at the studio on a certain, I think it was a Saturday or some evening. And when I got down there, thinking I was the only one going to be there, on the stage were about 20, 25 contestants. And it was an elimination contest. And the prize was a wristwatch, either for a man or a woman, whoever won it. And there were people of all ages, down to...
Did you win the watch?
I won the watch. And you know, Jack, I was so pleased and so proud because all of the questions during the elimination contest, and it got down to the very last one, and I was the only one left on stage, and it was all of the questions were about Canada.
And you knew them all. Well, thank you very much, my dear. 685-918.
We had a guy working for the Muzak Wired Music Division, CJOR, which shared the space in the studio where we had our audience. And this young fella bore a tremendous resemblance to Eddie Fisher, who was peaking about then. He was the Perry Como, the whatever. Eh? The kid would come in, and I had a studio full of teeny boppers after school. And I said, well, look who stepped in, Eddie Fisher. We kidded the guy, and he went along with it. He had even let a few bars out a cappella without sounding too unlike Eddie Fisher. Kids downtown knew it wasn't, but the kids at home, hey, wow, Eddie Fisher's down there, you know? And as they say, the star was the draw. And they weren't groups. They were individual stars then. So somebody got the bright idea, I think it was me, that maybe Eddie Fisher was going to have to hurry out to the airport and, you know, catch a ship for Los Angeles or something. Whereupon, I think the switchboard just did a blue funk right there. The province phone, the Sun phone, how come we don't know Fisher's in town? There was a slow news day. And I thought this was just terribly exciting that we had aroused the town. Robinson did it later with a whale on the beach, for April Fools. But we had the Eddie Fisher hoax, and Vic took me aside very quietly because he looked after me well. He tried to keep me out of jail and any other places.
I did the George Sanders hoax one night.
What was that?
Well, Monty McFarlane used to do the Bing Crosby program between 9:45 and 10, just prior to the 10 o'clock news. And Monty phoned me one night and said, look, I can't make it. He said, well, you do the show. And, you know, they were kind of desperate days. You were given so many assignments to do, and I thought, oh, I kind of went haywire. And I sat down, And I did a very good impression of George Sanders at that time.
Oh, yeah.
This is George Sanders. Mrs. Sanders and I are up here doing a little fishing in British Columbia. And I said that I was doing the Bing Crosby show tonight in place of Monty McFarlane. So I did I did the whole thing through in the George Sanders voice and signed off. And Les Wedman phoned. Said, I didn't know George was in town. Where's George? Where's he staying?
Good stuff. You haven't mentioned Laddie Watkus.
Laddie Watkus was the backbone of CJOR for many, many years. I think she came shortly after George bought the station, and her first job was as secretary, accountant, bill collector, and entertainer. And she entertained with piano recitals, and she used the name Laddie Watkus. She accompanied herself on one of the old Kanabe grand pianos down there. And then she would accompany Cardo Smalley on the violin, and she took a different name when she accompanied Cardo Smalley on the violin. And she did so many different things. She was on the air. She used three names on the air. But it was always Laddie Watkus doing this thing. You know, all hours of the day and night, thumping on doors, you know, collecting bills and all the rest of it. She was the mother figure of CJOR. And when about 12 of us went overseas during WW2, she kept in touch with every one of us. And an amazing thing happened to Laddie. She was out to lunch one day in about 1944 or 45, and your news mind will have to correct me on this date. She was walking back from her lunch, coming down Howe Street, and some paper came zigzagging down in front of her in the wind from up in the sky. The Green Park had exploded. Yes, and she picked up this piece of paper, and it was a letter from Thelma to me with a picture of Richard. And she held it in her hands and thought, you know, God Almighty, how do I suddenly come into possession of a letter from Vic, or from Thelma to Vic, and a picture of young Rick, my boy? And
it had been blown up in the Green Park.
Went up in the Green Park.
It was on its way to Australia, was it?
And came zigzagging down up in Howe Street in front of the Grosvenor Hotel. I still have that at home. Laddie put it in an envelope and sent it to me, saying she didn't know how she came into possession of it, but there it was.
That's one in a million, isn't it?
That is a beauty. That is a super story, Vic.
Tell me, what was I like when I came in 53? Brash.
Yeah, you were kind of brash, but underneath it all, you're the same as you are today. You're a very tender soul, and I think you have love for a great many people. And you're a great big fraud, but you are the best newsman in British Columbia, in Canada, I would say. And I'm not giving you idle flattery. No one has had such impact on radio news in Canada since that day in 53 when you came to CJOR. As witness the fact that you are a host to prime ministers, presidents, kings, and even more important, Gordon Jackson, whom I love dearly, upstairs, downstairs.
But I've stopped doing the drug addicts, the pimps, the hookers. Although we were the pioneers, I lay proud claim to the fact that we were the first people to bring the really seamy side of life to radio in this country. Now, telephone calls. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Jack.
Hi.
Can I speak to Vic?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, okay. Hi, Vic.
Hi there.
Do you remember giving recipes on the radio?
Yes, I sure did.
Cornish pasties.
Yeah, right. I'm the only person in Vancouver, I shouldn't say I am. Thelma is the only girl in Vancouver, and she's a Lebanese, that can make Cornish pasty the proper way.
Is that right? Yeah. I think at that time you talked about how your mother made it, and it had to be the skirt steak. There was nothing else.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right. And Vic, was it you that did the professor at night?
No, a lot of people thought I was the professor.
I didn't think you were, but...
I remember the professor.
The fellow with the buns in his pocket?
Yeah.
Shabby old man with a bun. Did he wear a top hat?
No, he wore a bowler.
A trench coat or something.
A bowler.
A burberry and a bowler.
That's right,
Who was the professor?
His name was Herbert Allen Francis. He was actually a person. He lived. He was one of Vancouver's great characters. He had been, in his younger days, a very competent musician to the level where he could perform, say, before the Winnipeg Women's Philharmonia Society or something like that. He became eccentric and used to drop in on me every Saturday night at 11 o'clock. He was a great moocher. He used to wander over to the Hotel Vancouver and bum a meal out of Art Cameron. He had many, many tricks, and he always talked about having his déjeuner and so on and so forth. He was a lovely old man, really, and Jack Wasserman.
Did he go on the air with you?
Oh, yes, he went on the air with me.
Philosopher?
Yes, he was kind of a philosopher. Jack Wasserman was a pallbearer along with myself and other Vancouver notables at his funeral from from Christ Church Cathedral, the shabby old man was buried, and Dean Cecil Swanson insisted on taking the service himself. And the theme of the service was, there are among us everyday people we regard as being a little bit different, but by God, they are God's people. Give them respect.
Thank you, ma'am. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello, Vic?
Yes.
You don't know me, but I know people that you know. I'll tell you, when I heard the name of Jerry Wilmot mentioned, could you tell me, do you know where he is now?
He's in England.
Is he still in England?
Sure he is.
Well, you see, he left CJOR a little earlier than you thought he did, because he was my announcer on my own show back in Montreal over the CBC for 3 years.
What's your name?
Emilia Heyman. And I was announced as Amelia and her accordion, and I had a 15-minute song and accordion music on the CBC for 3 years.
And Jerry announced you?
As Amelia and her accordion.
Have you still got the accordion?
Oh, yes. And he was on with me from 37, 38, 39. And after that, he went as a war correspondent with the armed forces to England in the late 39, early 40.
Quite correct.
And I haven't seen him since. And I've often wondered where he was. He was such a good friend.
Oh, he was. I think he's still in England, Amelia. Look after your accordion.
Yes, and I also play the Wurlitzer organ, too, now. And I do a lot of work for the senior citizens and all that. I mean, I'm not that old yet. Don't get me wrong.
You're not any older than we are.
Oh, God, nobody's older than you.
Thank you, Amelia, for that closing chord. Yes, yes.
Hello?
Yes, yes.
Oh, thank you, Jack, for answering. I would like to speak to Vic.
Go ahead, please.
Vic, I don't care about all the rest of the people that have been on CJOR, but if there was no one else that they ever brought to the people of Vancouver, you are just a jewel.
I can only agree with that.
I know.
Golden boy.
Talk about the mad things that everybody else did on the air. You remember the morning we sent my husband to work thinking he only had one shoe on?
Gosh, no, I can't remember that.
The Quiet Man?
Mm-hmm, yes, I remember The Quiet Man, that's right.
And you were speaking about Gigi.
Who was The Quiet Man?
My husband. Mm-hmm. We used to play dirty tricks on him in the morning. He was half asleep when he went to work, and he didn't know what was going on. And he came home that night, and he said, do you know I stopped and looked to see if I did have both my shoes on?
You mean Vic did this on the air?
Yes, when he had his morning program. And will you ever forget Gigi's bloody old nickel club?
Well, the nickel club, Gigi took part in it. I think the nickel club was inspired by Dick Diespecker.
Yeah, a nickel for the dog and the cat. And
that's right, yep, the whole bit. And the celebrities used to come down and drop the nickels in the mason jars.
And everything else, yeah. And one other person I had lost track of, and I hadn't heard anybody speak of recently. What happened, or where is Rio Thompson?
Gee, I don't know. Rio went back east in the Alu.
Yes, Rio passed on some while ago. He went with the All Canada radio
That's
chain,
right.
And he was quite a salesman,
or was he?
No, he was a program director. I worked under Rio down
in
Seymour Street.
Right.
Yeah,
and he had a beautiful jazz program on Saturday afternoons.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, ma'am. Webster, Waters, and Jordan, or Jordan, Waters, and Webster, at. Sorry, Jack Short isn't here, but he's going on another program, I think, dear old Jack. Was it Short who invented the name City Mike, or was it a fellow called Heaps who died?
I don't know.
Remember Jack
Heaps? I don't know. But we had a swindler on CJOR at one time.
Who?
A swindler. Had a regular 15-minute broadcast on CJOR, and we almost all of us wound up in the pokey over that.
Who was he?
I can't remember this timid, skinny, little, bald-headed man who was a financial analyst, but the name of his game was to come down and give people a picture of the market and how it was behaving and what it could and what it might do, and he surreptitiously used to slip in mentions of stocks, which he'd bought the day before, and so he was therefore recommending people go out and buy these stocks. And so naturally, a lot of them would get a good little lift, and the little weasel would sell them, you see. So one day, we had some security people from the stock exchange and a number of other figures in trench coats come down saying, where can we get in touch with that man? That was the last we ever saw of him.
685-9181. Reg Dagger used to be in the business not so many years ago.
Not so many?
How many years ago, Reg?
I'll date you all. I was on OR at 1930 to about 1934.
Reg, didn't you go to CKMO?
After that long, I don't know.
50 to 34. What were things like then, Reg?
Well, I'll tell you, I started at $15 a week. George gave us, Jerry Wilmot was there then, and Don Forbes. And he gave us each three checks, $5 each. We could cash the first one. The second one was postdated for 2 days. The next was postdated for 4 days.
Where did you eat, Reg? What restaurant did you eat at for free?
We had contra accounts on some restaurants.
Yeah, we sure did.
Yeah.
And you could get free meals at these restaurants.
That's about the only way we got them.
And shoes at Cop Shoe Store.
We lived mostly on Glory in those days.
What were you doing then, Reg, on the air?
Well, we did everything from sweeping the studio out in the morning to sports and what you now call disc jockey. And then I did a little bit of singing with Art Hallman. We called the act the Two Little Fellers. And our studio at that time, at first, was above the Alexander Ballroom.
Right.
Which used to be at Hornby and Robson.
You mean the one that later Jack Cullen used to use as his studio and my studio in NW?
That could be. And then Mark Kenny played underneath us in the ballroom. I don't think Mark knows to this day how often he was on the air. Still in time, because we had a carbon mic hanging over the head of the orchestra.
And you just push him up, punch him up, and put him on the air.
We ran out of records. We just push a button. Mark would be on the air. Of course, the union didn't know either, so nobody got paid for it.
How old are you now, Reg?
Well, come August, I'll be 70.
Not bad.
Yeah.
And you went on to CKMO and then on to many other things after that.
WX.
Yeah. Reg, thanks very much for your call.
Well, happy birthday to all of you.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, please.
Well, happy birthday to you, Mr. Webster, and to the rest of the boys there. Mm. Whatever happened to Uncle Jerry, who used to have his theme song was Rig-a-Jig-Jig and Away We Go?
It sounds more like Jackie Gleason. Okay, come on, somebody. Jordan or Waters. Rig-a-Jig-Jig and Away We Go.
Yeah, I know. Ross used to play that on Kitty's Carnival. And somebody phoned up and said it was obscene in his language, which was, I don't know, somewhere between Pakistan and Nepal or something. He said Rig-a-Jig-Jig was a nasty bit of business and we shouldn't use it on the air.
And you can't remember. You have stumped Waters and Jordan.
I believe he has gone to Australia. That's the last I heard.
Do you remember his name?
No, the last name was something like Diesbecker, or a name like that.
Diesbecker's in California.
He's dead.
Is he dead?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
He had a PR business in California.
Yeah, that's right, down in San Francisco. Mm-hmm.
Rich children's entertainer in the 30s.
Yeah, that's right. I remember the Rig-a-Jig-Jig and Away We Go and all the rest of it. Who Uncle Jerry was, I don't know. It could have been a pseudonym because, Leo Nicholson was Uncle Billy and his kids or something like that when he did the afternoon talent show.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, Rig-a-Jig-Jig and Away We Go.